She chided him for being a spiritualist, spitting the word out with distaste, accusing him of working with the devil. Somewhat deflated, Ted tried to lend weight to his arguments by telling Aunt Maggie that Alec and I were in the movement. On hearing this, her eyes rolled in horror. She threw up her arms and prayed aloud for our salvation. Ted deemed it wise to beat a hasty retreat. Not long after this unfortunate encounter, my mother and I held a séance. Alec was entranced. To our surprise, we heard Jeanette's voice. She addressed my mother, saying, "Auntie Polly, please go and see my mother. She is very ill. Tell her we are with her, helping. Say that we love her very much." Mother promised to do this. Next morning, though she rarely went out, she rose early, dressed, and caught the bus, 46, for Aunt Maggie's house. As Mother alighted at her destination, she was surprised to see Ted getting off the bus in the opposite direction. Ted was flabbergasted at seeing Mother so far from home at that early hour and asked the reason. Mother explained, she was on her way to see Maggie and related Jeanette's urgent request at the previous night's séance. Ted exclaimed in surprise, "But that's an extraordinary coincidence. Ethel came to our circle last night and said the same thing. That is why I am here. I have not seen Aunt Maggie for a couple of weeks, so wasn't aware of her illness." "That is very strange," Mother replied. "Both girls bringing the same message at the same time but in different places." She pondered a moment, then said, "I fear there must be something very wrong with Maggie. Let's go quickly and see for ourselves." Sure enough, they found Maggie gravely ill. Both Ted and Mother passed on her daughter's spirit messages. Maggie found them difficult to understand, believing that they had gone from her forever. She smiled, then murmured, "Oh, if only I could accept that." Hope flickered momentarily in her eyes. "How happy I should be." Then her face clouded as she remembered her firmly entrenched beliefs. "But that is not possible. They are in their graves." "Listen, Maggie, my girl," Mother said gently, but earnestly, "I am telling you the truth. You must believe me. They did come to us last night, through Alec and Ted. They want you to know they're not asleep in their graves awaiting a trumpet call of Christ's second coming. They are alive and with you now. How else did they know you were ill? And how could they come to tell us if, 47, this were not so? We knew nothing of your sickness." Aunt Maggie seemed a little happier at that, though not entirely satisfied, as she sank back among her pillows. But a ray of hope had been given to her. Within the months she passed on during her sleep, one can imagine the joy she experienced at being reunited with her three lovely girls. I have told this story because it had a sequel which gave irrefutable evidence that Maggie, Connie and my father were still alive, albeit in another dimension. To prove it, they materialized with such clarity and physical detail that we had no difficulty in recognizing them. This manifestation occurred when famous materialization medium Helen Duncan demonstrated at our spiritualist church. Mary, Alec and I were fortunate in obtaining three of the greatly coveted seats. Alec bought a bunch of violets to give to Connie. On arrival, he placed these flowers inside the séance cabinet. The Helen Duncan demonstration began with the usual procedures. Prayers were recited, followed by a few hymns. Very soon phenomena began to happen. A cultured male voice, with a strong Cambridge accent, the medium was a Scot, announced itself as Albert Stewart, Mrs. Duncan's guide. Albert welcomed us to the circle, giving explicit instructions on how we should approach the materialized forms. He also issued advice about conducting ourselves during the séance. This done, the curtains were parted, revealing that the medium was in deep trance. A tall male figure in a flowing white robe stood beside her, his hand on her shoulder. I was utterly fascinated. It was my first materialization experience. Alec and Mary were, 48, equally enthralled. After Albert materialized, many others came to show themselves and bring messages. Though it was a marvelous experience, we were somewhat detached from those communicators who were not known to us. We waited anxiously for a loved one of ours to bring the evidence we needed. We were not disappointed. After a while, a beautiful young girl stepped out of the cabinet. It was Connie. Every feature was as it had been when we last saw her. To Alec's joy, she held his flowers in her hands. "Thanks, darlings, for the violets," she said softly, but quite distinctly. Then she handed the posy to Alec. The extraordinary thing was that after they had been handled by Connie, the violets lasted for weeks without withering. As we left the church, I was conscious of a certain disappointment that Father had not shown himself. I consoled myself by acknowledging that what I had seen was very rewarding. I wanted Dad to witness these marvelous manifestations. He did such good work round the valleys, giving so much, taking church services, always rendering very convincing clairvoyance. Ted was a popular medium. When he demonstrated, the churches were filled to capacity. I felt that a sitting with Helen Duncan would help and encourage him further. I also thought that Father would most certainly materialize for Ted. Ted was excited at the idea, and a sitting was arranged. Afterwards, I anxiously asked if he had seen Father. He replied that he had not. But guess who did come? Maggie. Knowing her antipathy to spiritualism, I was most surprised. "Maggie!" I exclaimed. 49. "Yes," Ted affirmed, "Maggie. She came out of the cabinet looking just as she had on Earth. She put her hands on my shoulders and said, 'Teddy.' She was the only one in the family who ever called me that." Ted's voice was full of excitement as he underlined this piece of evidence. Then he continued. "Teddy," she said, "I've come to tell you that you are right about spiritualism. I was wrong. You must carry on this good work." Ted laughed delightedly. "But what about Father?" I asked. "Did he come?" I asked Aunt Maggie if he would. She said, "He's here, Teddy. He helped me to come. He thought it would be more convincing for you if he did it that way." We had to wait several months before Helen Duncan returned to our church. Again, Mother, Alec and I sat in the front row beside the cabinet, anxiously waiting Father's materialization. This time we felt certain he would come. The previous night he returned at our circle and said that the guides were busy preparing him. They would help him to materialize at the Duncan seance. Father promised we would be able to recognize him. It was with bated breath we waited for Albert to conclude his usual preliminaries. This done, he paused, looking around. His eyes rested on our little group. I could scarcely breathe. "There is a gentleman here," he began, "who wishes to come to the lady in the front row." I could barely contain my excitement. "For me?" I gasped. "Has he come for me?" "He has come for the lady next to you," came the reply. "But for you also." With that the curtains parted and my beloved father stepped from the cabinet. He came forward, his arms out, 50, stretched to Mother. "Pull," he said, gently, "I am with you." Mother went to him. There followed a quiet conversation between them, too personal to relate. There was no doubt in our minds it was Dad. Before Father appeared, Albert instructed us to remove the handkerchief shading the red light used at materialization seances. Father, he explained, would be able to tolerate the increased luminosity. He is anxious to show himself clearly to his loved ones, the guide added. We looked closely at Dad, hardly believing he was before us. Every feature was clear. His eyes, the texture of his skin, every line and detail of his face, were there for all to witness. Apart from the visual proof, he appeared as solid as I when I took his hand. He bent and kissed me lightly on the cheek. A week or so later, I was browsing at the library and found a book, Towards the Stars, by Dennis Bradley. The title intrigued me. I took the volume home. It was a very comprehensive report of the investigations undertaken by the author into the direct voice mediumship of George Valentine, a well-known American medium. Every time I picked up the book, a voice said, "You can get that." Puzzled, I dismissed the suggestion from my mind as imagination. However, the voice was so persistent I decided to discuss it with Mary Hewitt. She took the matter seriously. She did not think it was imagination, but someone was trying to impress me that we should sit for direct voice. At our next circle, I asked Tiwanga if we should try to obtain direct voice. Without hesitation he said, "Getter, 51, Cone, Louis, 1, and wait." He was, of course, referring to a megaphone-shaped seance trumpet. Every time we attended the spiritualist church, the demonstrating medium would single out Alec or me and tell us about the great work we had to do or that there were plans for our future in spiritualism. It was all very well, but up to that point nothing had been made clear as to what these were to be. Our circle seemed to follow the same pattern with no change. It is understandable why the controlling guides sent a gentle spirit visitor to encourage me, through the entranced Alec. Softly spoken, supplying her name as Patience, she came to bring me patience, of which I was sorely in need. She told us to persevere. Ultimately, we would attain what we were striving for. We were greatly heartened by her words and after that better able to endure the delays encountered. Time passed. We tried to wait patiently for those on the other side to move when they were ready. Then, quite unexpectedly, our new, important guide made himself known to us. Through Alec came a deep resonant voice, announcing, "I am White Wing." Alec, controlled, rose to his feet, seeming to gain in stature as he came towards me. "I belong to you, faithful," he said, taking my hands in his. "There is much work for you to do." "Here we go again," I thought, and smiled wanly. "I repeat," came the rich voice, "there is much work for you to do. Your world needs the help we will bring. We look to you to aid us to carry it through. I will speak simply. Your man is like the engine. You are the power which makes it go. White Wing not promise riches, but you will have sufficient for your needs." 52. "Now, the path is narrow and difficult, but White Wing say, one day it will be a long, wide road. Hundreds will travel along it with you." I was quite overcome by his words. I felt so close to this wonderful soul that I was prepared to do all I could to help him in his work. I even offered to give up my music if it was necessary. "White Twing," he answered seriously, "may even ask that of you, faithful." I was touched by the beautiful name he gave me, and wondered why he had called me that. As if picking up my thoughts, he said, "My name for you is Faithful because White Wing know you will always be faithful even through difficult times. One day," he prophesied, "when you come over to White Wing, there will be a reward for your faithfulness. May the Great White Spirit bless you." The guide withdrew, promising to come again. We were to become very close over the years. He tutored me in all subjects relating to spirit matters. I discovered how little I really knew. I was virtually an ignoramus, as far as this topic was concerned, until White Wing took me in hand. I became his eager and diligent pupil, trusting him completely. Never once did I find him to be wrong. We bore in mind White Wing's injunction, given at a subsequent circle, to sift and question all that purports to come from the other side. "Never accept anything if your better judgment indicates that it is unacceptable." He told us that so many people accepted wholeheartedly and unquestioningly every single utterance from a medium. They did not realize that, in the developing stages particularly, things could go wrong. 53. Permitting interference and distortion to take place. This warning made us cautious of any manifestation we encountered. At this time, we started to experience quite a lot of physical phenomena in our home, even in comparatively bright light. Objects moved for no apparent reason, teaspoons were lifted by unseen hands and tapped against saucers, and so on. Alec disliked being in trance. He was unable to witness any of the manifestations that took place. To conciliate him, so that his interest would not flag, I agreed to sit sometimes for automatic writing so that he would be able consciously to participate in the spirit communication. One evening, Alec said he had an urge to put the pencil in his left hand. It was only a small stub, and difficult to hold. I was very surprised to see him insert it between the first and second fingers of the left hand. Being right-handed, this would make writing a difficult undertaking. No sooner had Alec grasped the pencil between his fingers than it began to write quickly on the blank piece of paper before him. Though it commenced at the left-hand margin of the paper, the script started with the last word at the end of the sentence. It finished on the right of the paper with the word beginning that sentence. In other words, the communication was back to front. And to make things even more complicated, the script was upside down. The finished message, written in this manner, was legible to me, sitting directly opposite Alec, but not to him. The letters were written at great speed. Three times the pencil wrote the same message, and always back to front and upside down. It was, "Tell Mary, keep away from London." 54. "Which Mary?" I asked. "Hewitt, your friend," wrote the pencil. "Who is it who is writing this?" I probed. "Bert," came the reply. At this juncture, we noticed a strange acrid smell. I sniffed, and turned to Alec, saying, "Can yon smell something? It's like sulfur burning." Alec's nostrils twitched. "It's like the smell left after a shell has exploded. I remember it only too well." No immediate explanation was forthcoming, either about Bert or the strange odor. A few weeks later we learned that Alec Hewitt's brother, Bert, had been killed by a shell burst in the First World War. It was Bert's first contact with us, but he subsequently communicated frequently after that for many years. After receiving Bert's warning, it was too late to deliver it to Mary. Early next morning I made a point of doing so, knowing that sometimes Mary drove to London at weekends. As she read the message, Mary's face showed her amazement. She was visibly upset. She told me it seemed inevitable she would have to go to London. Her husband had mentioned, only the night before, that he intended to operate his business from the capital and wanted to reside in London. "But we shall have to have second thoughts before moving, won't we?" she said gravely. I read that it was absolutely essential to sit in complete darkness to achieve direct voice with only the seance trumpet edged with a band of luminous paint round its 55 wider end to make it visible to sitters. I was disconcerted, having no desire to sit in the dark. Alec and I continued to meditate in red light. The guides apparently decided to take me in hand and condition me to sitting in darkness. No sooner had we commenced our meditation than the light went out. Afterwards we would discover that the globe filament had been destroyed. Time and again this happened. I felt a growing annoyance as the pile of broken globes increased. As usual when in difficulties, I consulted Mary Hewitt. I told her about this new problem, explaining that the guides were being fractious, if not a little destructive, in their efforts to persuade us to sit in darkness. She smiled, amused at the battle of wills between two worlds, and offered to attend that night and observe what took place. Sure enough, the same phenomenon happened. As soon as our sitting commenced, out went the light. Mary chuckled, shaking her head wisely. "I'm afraid you will have to learn to comply with the guides' wishes," she said. "They are in charge and will brook no interference with their arrangements. Try sitting in darkness, otherwise I don't think you'll get what you are looking for." I sighed, grudgingly agreeing. To our surprise, thereafter the guides put the light on and off at will without manipulating the switch. I made no move to interfere. Mary and her husband eventually left our district to live in London, despite Bert's warning. I felt her loss keenly. Where would I go now, I wondered, when I encountered the inevitable problems. The spirit people, always aware of our thoughts, were, 56, quick to console me and allay my fears. I received a message through a visiting medium at the spiritualist church. It was, "You must not be upset. One friend has left you, but two more will come later to help in the work you are undertaking." Alec and I continued our evening meditation sittings in the dark. Before we sat, I placed the luminous trumpet on the mantelpiece. Here it would remain, resolutely immobile, apparently disinterested in the proceedings. One night, quite unexpectedly, just as we were about to close, to our amazement the trumpet moved. It rose, and glided silently across the mantelpiece, coming to rest on the opposite side. The trumpet avoided two vases which stood in its pathway. Simultaneously, a loud rattling sound was heard, as if pebbles are being thrown against the door. The sudden noise startled us, but we were very excited and waited expectantly for further manifestations to occur. The trumpet made no more excursions. We closed the sitting. To say we were pleased with what had occurred would be a gross understatement. We were both thrilled. The exciting possibility of future phenomena so unsettled us that when we finally went to bed, sleep eluded us. We lay awake into the small hours, contemplating the wondrous manifestations which might lie ahead for our circle. Uppermost in my mind was a deep sense of gratitude to those dedicated guides who were working so tirelessly to help us achieve our objective. The following Sunday, I invited a friend, Betty, to join us in the séance room. She was a young daughter of an acquaintance of my mother. Betty's mother had passed, 57, not long before. A week earlier, I received a message from her through the church medium to relay to Betty. I thought it would be nice for her to speak to her mother, hence the invitation. Just before we commenced sitting, Betty's cousin, Murdoch, arrived asking for her. He had locked himself out of the house Murdoch was staying with Betty and her family and came to borrow her key. Murdoch was such a personable young man, I felt drawn to him, and asked him to join us. Alternatively, I said, he could wait in the lounge until the circle ended. Alec approached Murdoch and tried to persuade him to join the sitters, saying, "You are a Gammy Scott. I would be grateful for your unbiased observations on what takes place at our circles. I'd like to know what really goes on. I can't believe half of what they tell me. I'm unconscious all the time." Seeing the puzzled expression on Murdoch's face, Alec explained about his trance mediumship. Murdoch nodded his understanding, agreeing to accompany Betty into the séance room. It was their first experience of spirit communication, so I gave them a short explanation of what to expect. Alec went into trance. Iwonga was the first to communicate with this advice: "The time is right for you to sit for voice, but Iwonga say who shall sit. Iwonga know best." Each sitter was expectant, hoping to be chosen for the voice circle. Iwonga's deep voice resumed, "First, Alec and Louis, and," addressing Betty and Murdoch, "perhaps this lady and gentleman would be kind enough to help us by giving their time each week. If, of course, they are interested." The pair indicated that they were, and willing to join 58, the circle. Then, with characteristic courtesy, Iwonga begged the remaining sitters not to be disappointed because they had not been selected. "These four I have chosen," he explained, "have what is necessary in their bodily emanations to obtain direct voice. If they sit alone, quite apart from your present group, voice will come quickly." Noticing some of the sitters seemed a trifle downcast, he added a word of comfort, "Afterwards, you will all benefit from their efforts. Once they have been successful, voice will then come to your Sunday circle." This relieved their despondency. Iwonga continued, "White Wing will give you your instructions next Sunday. I suggest you start sitting for voice the following Tuesday. I wish you success, Louis One. May God bless your efforts." He withdrew, leaving us greatly encouraged, anxious to start the new Tuesday circle. As Betty lived very near the theater where I worked, we decided to hold the voice sittings at her house. I could go there between shows. We would be able to sit for 1¼ hours weekly. At the Sunday circle, when White Wing gave us our instructions, he stressed the importance of regularity. "Never miss one sitting," he urged. "It is essential that the link is not broken." We all complied with his instructions to the smallest detail. Even Murdoch, a traveler, made sure he never left Cardiff on Tuesdays. After sitting for 9 Tuesdays, we had a setback. On the 10th, Alec inexplicably failed to appear for the circle. Feeling hurt and disappointed that he had let us and the spirit people down, we realized he was probably tired of sitting week after week, with nothing to show for his pains but 59 negative results. But did we not all feel the same? Only White Wing's injunctions regarding the importance of regularity and keeping the link unbroken bolstered our flagging interest. Rather than cancel the sitting, we held the circle with the three of us, Murdoch, Betty and me. White Wing had instructed us to sit around a table with our hands resting on it. The little fingers of each hand were to be in contact with those of the sitters on either side of us, thumbs had to be kept apart. He also advised us to let water flow through the trumpet before laying it on the table. The instructions carried out, we commenced. Very soon we were amazed to see the trumpet roll around the table. Slowly it crept onto my hands, remained there for a moment, then returned to the table's center where it became stationary again. We were more than pleased with our progress. As we closed the circle, Each of us experienced a feeling of achievement. At last, something positive had happened. We were getting somewhere, we felt, if the trumpet moved at all. Our weeks of patient sitting had not been a waste of time. I got home to find Alec waiting for me, looking somewhat sheepish. "How did the voice circle go this evening?" he asked. "Anything spectacular happen?" Still feeling hurt by his deliberate boycott, I retorted angrily, "How dare you ask that? You should be ashamed of yourself, letting the guides down like that. Have you forgotten what White Wing said about not breaking the link? You needn't bother to come again if you don't want to." "What are you talking about?" said Alec. I could see he was curious. 60. "The trumpet moved without you, that's all."
"It moved?"
He looked incredulous. "I don't believe it." "It did," I said simply. I told Alec that White Wing had insisted he was not to become entranced at the voice circles. It was intended I should be the medium for these. I asked Alec if he was willing to help me develop in that field. To my relief, he readily agreed, only too happy to be able to witness the proceedings himself for a change. The following Sunday, White Wing said the room we were using was not satisfactory since it was too large. He asked us to sit in a smaller one. Betty had a sewing room which seemed ideal for our purpose. Having blacked it out satisfactorily, we used this the next Tuesday. We commenced the circle with a new format, Alec remaining conscious throughout. The prayers and preliminaries completed, we were greatly surprised to see the trumpet rise from the table and move swiftly about the room. It was obviously directed by unseen hands. Later we learned that to perform this feat, psychic rods were used, fashioned from ectoplasm drawn from the sitters and the medium. While we were all congratulating ourselves and spirit friends on the degree of success attained, the trumpet suddenly fell to the floor with a clatter. It brought gasps of dismay from all of us. Thinking that the power had diminished, we sang a hymn, bringing in the sheaves, at the top of our voices. This was to raise the vibrations. It had the desired effect. The trumpet began slowly to creep along the floor. It edged itself along until reaching my feet. Then the trumpet crept up my leg, moving up the side of my body, 61, to my shoulder. I sat motionless, scarcely able to breathe, lest I impeded it in any way. It then descended, returning to the table where it came to rest. As I closed the circle, the trumpet moved again and came to me, laying itself on my clasped hands, pressing down heavily, as if to indicate that our spirit friends were joining with us in prayer. It was a reassuring gesture. 62. Chapter 5. Physical impossibilities occur. Those in charge of my husband's mediumship now plan to take his development a step further. Chang, speaking through him, announced, "Alec must go in cabinet." "But, Chang," I protested, "Alec says he will never sit in a cabinet. He doesn't like being confined." "Little lady," the oriental voice intoned firmly, "when Chang say medium go in cabinet he must go." Disconcerted, knowing Alec's aversion to cabinets, I asked White Wing for an explanation. If I was the voice medium, surely it was not necessary for Alec to sit in the cabinet. "Faithful," came the calm, rich tones, "you are the voice medium, but Alec is a very powerful physical one. We have decided that instead of developing you separately, we will endeavor to blend the power. Alec will go into trance. You must be the conscious half. It is essential that a physical medium has a conscious counterpart to take care of him. Alec will have voice manifestations only if you are present." I was quite happy with this new arrangement and felt greatly thrilled. Alec was far from pleased. "Why do I have to go into trance?" he complained. "And why in a cabinet, for heaven's sake?" 63. I did my best to explain what White Wing had said. Alec grudgingly consented to do as Chang asked. Now that his physical mediumship had been launched, a new guide joined us. Christopher became an important member of our band of spirit helpers. He was an intermediary between circle members and beings on a higher plane who gave information and instructions regarding the handling of the circle in general and the medium in particular. Christopher received these instructions and relayed them to us. The advice was wise, helpful and invaluable at all times. We accepted what he said without question, always believing that Christopher knew best. He never materialized, but usually spoke in independent voice,